when he will likely announce whether a strike at Daimler will happen. 96% of Daimler UAW members voted to authorize a strike in March. The UAW has filed unfair labor practice charges against the company for violations of federal labor law and for failing to bargain in good faith. Last fall, auto workers at the big three Detroit car companies won substantial new contracts following an historic strike. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 61 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 60 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Greetings, 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 y bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, in District of Columbia, here on this Friday, April 26, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Israel's role in genocide in Guatemala in the 1980s and how its role at the service of U.S. imperial interests during this time period in Central America should serve as a crucial frame of reference in the Gaza Strip today. And so with us on the show today is Mark Lewis Taylor. He's a Maxwell Upson Professor of Theology and Culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. He has a fantastic article in Counterpunch entitled Israel and Genocide, Not Only in Gaza. Welcome to the show, Mark Lewis Taylor.
Say, I'm glad to be here with you.
Absolutely. This is such a fantastic article that even NACLA and Jacobin have republished this article. And it's such a crucial frame of reference, as I said before, with regards to what's taking place in Gaza today. So usually my intros are a lot longer, but we have a lot to discuss here. And considering all the protests that we've seen in college campuses in the last few weeks, needless to say, quite important in these times. So you presented a lot of important dates that point to direct involvement by Israel in Guatemala's dictatorship in the 1980s. But let's begin in 1977 during the Jimmy Carter administration, when the U.S. cut off most of its military aid to Guatemala due to its notorious record of human rights abuses. So beginning here, can you explain the Israeli government's role at the service of the U.S.? Because looking over this article, which was fantastic, it almost sounds similar to the Iran-Contra scandal that would develop almost a decade later.
Interesting comparison. You're right to begin with this date of 1977. Israel did have connections to various points throughout Latin America before then, the history shows. But this was the very important date because U.S. President Jimmy Carter comes in after being president for 1 year, and he had this commitment, at least announced, didn't always follow through, but this announcement to defend human rights everywhere. So he cut off most of the military aid, as you said, to Guatemala due to a quite abysmal record on human rights. Soon thereafter, Ronald Reagan becomes president, and the state of Israel was used to as a kind of proxy to supply military aid to Guatemala, because still Reagan couldn't, in a forthright manner, there was still struggle to get rid of the ruling by Jimmy Carter and to get around Congress. But Israel eagerly stepped in, and in fact, it's something that Israel wanted to do in many parts of Latin America and other parts of the world too. In fact, Israel, according to one journalist in NACLA, North American Council on Latin America, said that Guatemala had as its principal military supplier Israel. In 1980, just 3 years after Carter, the army was fully re-equipped with Galil rifles. Those are the Israeli manufactured weapons, at a cost of some $6 million. And then in later years, Guatemalan military elites would boast of the role that Israel was playing. Throughout the article, I give other examples of Israel stepping in, Israel being acknowledged by Benedicto Garcia, one of the leading military generals of the time, by other figures as well. And there are a number of signs. We could go into them, but can I give you one of the most obvious modes of involvement at the time with the village of Dos Heres in 1982?
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but go ahead. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's an infamous massacre, one of many. There were some 500 villages destroyed, so it's important that we don't just center on one. But the Israeli connection there was clearly present. And I compared several reports of this, but at the village of Dos Heres on December 6, 1982, Israeli-trained commandos left the village completely burned down. After shooting, there was torture, raping over some 200 villages. A UN investigative team reported, and let me quote from it, I have it here, "All the ballistic evidence recovered corresponded to bullet fragments from firearms and pods of Galil rifles made in Israel." That's a translation of a report in the Spanish. It's a 12-volume study. The study of this has been exhaustive in Guatemala. And as I say, that's just the one village. That same 12-volume study reports that Israel-made rifles were present all through the highlands. And U.S.-made helicopters often ferried troops into the highlands for what the report argues were acts of genocide. And in fact, the report takes over 100 pages in its second volume to defend its usage of the term genocide.
So before we continue, I want to emphasize something that you just mentioned, that what we're discussing here is not exclusive to Central America. It's not exclusive to Latin America, that
indeed,
the Israeli government has been involved in some form of undermining democracy in various other parts of the world. We just did a show a few weeks ago with regards to the struggle for social justice in Honduras in the 1980s, and we indirectly mentioned Israeli assistance during the dictatorship in Honduras during that same time period as well. I'm Salvadoran, and I've been knowledgeable about some direct and indirect Israeli interference around that same time as well. One country doesn't really prove much, but when you add all these other countries together, now you have a theory, which you just mentioned, is sort of Israel being a proxy of the U.S. to circumvent U.S. law, which is why we started with that issue with Jimmy Carter not sending military aid to Guatemala in the first place. So
yes,
I want to go now to sort of your own personal history in Guatemala, because you were in Guatemala in the 80s when you first started making connections with Israel and Guatemala's dictatorship. Can you tell us about some of the red flags that you saw firsthand during your time in Guatemala that sort of galvanized you to study this connection further?
Yeah. When I first went to Guatemala in 1987, I went there as a young professor who was interested in setting up an exchange program for our students and some other students in Guatemala. And I wanted to go there and talk to people on the ground about the best way to do that for all parties concerned. I had also been involved in the United States in some solidarity work with Central America in order to cease U.S. funding of many military governments throughout Central America. So I went in with that kind of knowledge of the human rights abuses in Guatemala and the need to organize against them. I tell in the article the story of walking along a street with one of my colleagues that I was visiting with, and there comes this very loud barking order over a loudspeaker. It's kind of Darth Vader-like, and it's a little higher pitched, and it startles one. And I said, "What is that?" to my colleague. And he said, "Oh, here you have the latest import from Israel, these new Jeeps." I think they were military or police Jeeps that had come into the market, into Guatemala. And this got me thinking, Israel and Guatemala, what is that about? I mean, I went in knowing that the U.S. was a big funder, but I did not know about this important proxy role that Israel played. And just asking a few more questions to my colleague, it became apparent that Israel was supplying the Guatemala military and police with not only Jeeps like this, but training, equipment for surveillance of really quite a sophisticated sort at that time, as I'm told, as well as other kinds of military equipment. And ever since that time, I've been exploring the connection, at least at the activist level in the United States. I didn't make myself anything like an expert on Gaza or Israel, but this connection stayed with me and it was fascinating. And so more recently, I had to research and go more deeply into it. And I just wanted to comment on one of the last things you said concerning how widespread this is. You mentioned El Salvador, you mentioned Honduras. There are more materials than I could reference in this article showing how involved Israel has been in Latin America, all over Latin America. I just might recommend to your reviewers, this is what I do in the classroom, recommend a book. There's one by Bishara Bahba, B-A-H-B-A-H, who wrote a book called Israel and Latin America, The Military Connection. Came out in the mid-80s, in fact. I didn't know about it at the time, but it's a very good book. And it has a special chapter called The Special Case, which is all about Guatemala. So it gives you a picture of the whole, and it also lifts up the Guatemalan situation that I was writing about and that I had learned about.
And it goes back to what I said at the introduction, that this should be a very crucial frame of reference with regards to everything that's happening in recent times. But
yes,
before we get to recent times, there's still a lot more here that needs to be discussed, because although there was no social media to cover the Guatemalan genocide in the same way as we see Gaza today, there seems to have been quite a few red flags that pointed to Israeli involvement. So, for example, in your article, you cited Alan Nairn during his time at the Washington Post when he interviewed a Green Beret who openly talked about the use of Israeli-made firearms, which you just mentioned, and quote-unquote destroying towns.
Yes.
So you sort of mentioned this already, but I want to know if you could expand on this a little bit more, because it's quite shocking looking at the articles from both Alan Nairn and your recent article in Counterpunch to see how brazen people were during that time period and saying, yeah, Israelis supported us. They're helping us right now, destroying towns, in the words of this Green Beret.
Yes. And he is just one who acknowledged up front, at least a couple presidents make mention and thank the Israeli advisors. There were about 200 to 300 of them in the country at one crucial point in the late 70s and early 80s. I document that in the essay and trace those who have documented it very carefully. The general, one of the leading generals for Israel that was involved in overseeing Gaza for a time and was a hero of the early paramilitary moves by Israel against Palestinians. He points out that generals and those trained in the military in Israel were interested in looking all over the world for places to exercise their skills. I'm verging a bit more into the Gaza thing, but what's crucial here for understanding what's going on and was going on in Guatemala at this time is that the Palestinian territories were seen as kind of a laboratory for testing military weapons that then could be sent elsewhere. And one sees this carried out in numerous ways. I may just give you one more example here. One of the generals, again, Benedicto Lucas Garcia, who was involved in the sweeps across the highlands against the Maya peoples, he expressed appreciation for what he called, quote, the advice and transfer of electronic technology from Israel. This when he was speaking at a special ceremony opening the Guatemalan Army School of Transmission and Electronics. And this kind of speech even made it into the Manchester Guardian, as I show. So this is not known extensively to the U.S. public, but it was acknowledged openly in Guatemala that Israel had this connection.
And I'm not sure if you still follow Guatemalan politics today, but it should be pointed out that all these things that happened in the 1980s don't happen in a vacuum. As recently as last year, the daughter of the former dictator Efren Rios-Montt was running for president, even though the constitution in Guatemala specifically bans family members who were related to the dictatorship from running for office. And even as recently as last year, there are still mass graves being discovered and excavated during that time period, which some people would refer to as the Mayan genocide. So it's important to note that these things don't happen in a vacuum, neither in Guatemala nor in Israel. Now, I think the general that you're referring to, correct me if I'm wrong, is Matiyahu Peled. And I mention his name because I have him written in my notes here because he made a very interesting quote that I think sort of paraphrase here. He said, quote, Israel has given its soldiers practical training in the art of oppression and in methods of collective punishment. It is no wonder then that after their release from the army, some of those officers choose to make use of their knowledge in the service of dictators, and that those dictators are pleased to take in the Israeli experts. I wonder if you could expand on this, because one word there that really caught my attention is collective punishment, because, you know, we could use that as a component to define genocide, correct?
Yes, yes. I thought that phrase jumped out at me from General Peled's statement, an unusually frank and honest explanation of what's going on here. If you are committed to counterinsurgency, as the Guatemalan government was in its campaigns against the Maya, you're not just out to catch a few bad guys. You are out to intimidate a whole society and a whole people. The struggle, after all, was a struggle of a people for Maya self-determination, for freedom from impoverishment and the racism that was so flagrantly suffered by Maya peoples. And so the response to control this, and the Guatemala military was quite clear about this, that in order to counter the communism, which is the operative language at this point, to keep them at bay, you had to punish the whole collective, the society. And in many ways, this is what has been operative from the 1948 time of ethnic cleansing in Palestine and Gaza and continues. The punishment needs to be collective. This is the mindset of the counterinsurgent campaigners.
So let's go now to the million-dollar question here, which is the parallels between the Guatemalan genocide and Gaza today. And to do so, I want to quote you from your counterpart's article with the following. You say, quote, as with Israel and Gaza of Palestine, so with Guatemalan elites relative to the indigenous Maya, it is the historical record of decades of accumulative killing, occupation, forced removal, and dehumanization, which establish the acts and conditions as those of genocide, end quote. Can you expand on this argument as a means to draw further parallels? Because this is not only the center of your article, but the center of what we're discussing here And again, I cannot emphasize this enough, a huge frame of reference that is sorely missing in the narrative with regards to Gaza today.
Yes. Well, staying quite close to the passage that you just cited, I think I would like to accent the similarity between the conditions that have led analysts to see a genocidal condition here. When UN-associated human rights researchers were looking into all that went on in Guatemala in the Mayan genocide, or the Mayan Holocaust, as even one Shoah-related institute calls it, they reported that the Guatemalan military said what Israel says, oh, there's no intent here to eradicate the whole population, intent in part or at whole. And because there's no intent, this can't be genocide. They said they were working on economic and military and political conditions, and that these killings were part of a larger need foisted upon the government. Well, the analysts of this period in Guatemala determined that when you look at the historical record of decades, as they called it, accumulative killing and occupation and forced removal, it's in that sweep of history that you see the genocidal condition and why they argued for the use of the term genocide. Similarly, the court that responded to South Africa's petition arguing genocide, they made reference also to this history, even though in the case of Israel today, we have some statements that sound very much like individual intent is operative in some of the leaders when they call Palestinians animals or less than humans and talk about total eradication. I mean, this makes it a lot easier for the genocide label to stick. But what we have are two situations where over decades, you have a long history of dispossession, replete with torture and terror and forced removal and the like. And that's a very fundamental similarity. The second similarity that I'd like to point out is the geopolitics and the economics of international relations and the way they're operative here. Most of us who've been following Latin America for a long time know about structural adjustment plans where wealthy nations give massive loans to these poor countries designed to so-called help the country, but often all this money goes into the pockets of those who are already rich. The poor and the majorities don't see this, and yet the poor and middle classes get saddled with paying back the loan. It's a very vicious cycle. And when people rebel, then the military comes in to quash. Well, that political and economic pressure through institutions like the World Bank and the IMF is very powerful. It's right now being played out in places like Honduras and Guatemala in the way that the big banks fund mining industries that are going into Guatemala and Honduras to build big dams and reroute rivers and dispossess communities. And you have some of the same patterns playing out today. But now in the situation of Israel-Palestine, I think we need to remember that the IMF and the World Bank have been very involved in what's often called the normalization plan, where the U.S. tries to restructure the political economy of the Middle East so that Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, and some other nations too, are part of one political regional unit that normalize relations with each other in the sense of transcending this antagonism between Israel and Saudi Arabia. See, they want to normalize things. And the U.S. wants this very much because then there will be a military political entity in the Middle East, which will enforce the kind of political economy the U.S. wants in that area. And Palestine is expected to just be part of that without much consultation at all. And so they experience all of the vicissitudes of indebtedness and the like. There was a president of Palestine, not the prime minister like Abbas is today, but a president, Fayyad, and he worked up a relationship between Palestine and the World Bank and the IMF based on the principles of neoliberal political economy, many of the same principles that are operative between the United States and the big banks and Latin American countries like Guatemala. So we need to think about this political economic at the level of global economy as another important way to consider similarities between the two, between the U.S.-Guatemala connection and the U.S.-Israel-Palestine connection.
I saw an interview quite recently of Jared Kushner, and he spoke of Gaza. Considering everything we've seen in the last several months, he was speaking about Gaza as a real estate opportunity as opposed to a human catastrophe,
yes.
Which mm-hmm. sort of crystallizes what you just mentioned. And several years ago, a professor in Guatemala drew a map of the entire country and showed areas where there was Mayan and general resistance to dictatorship during the 1980s, and had another map of where the government in recent times have been pushing aggressively for privatization. And you put those two maps together and they overlap. And that sort of shows how economic warfare is not considered warfare because it's not as bloody as certainly what we saw in the 1980s. So we could definitely expand more on the economic motives with regards to Israel. I can understand, however heinous it is right now, I could see why their economic motives with what Israel's doing in Gaza. But for them to do the same thing half the world away in Guatemala, I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit more, because it's not enough just to be a proxy of the U.S. What more financial motives that they had during this time period? Because I know you also mentioned the agricultural sector in Guatemala as well as possibly another motive of Israel not only supporting the Guatemalan dictatorship, but also benefiting afterwards as well.
Yeah, the journalist George Block, who I cite working for NACLA, points out that there's an interlocking mesh between assistance programs in the area of agriculture, say, that Israel might foster and supported by the United States, and military aid. The agricultural assistance, though, is not the kind that would really benefit the masses of people in the country. They're often agro-export agricultural arrangements where you grow broccoli and other kinds of things largely for export, and you then press local communities, say in Guatemala or other countries, to work at low wages in that production scheme. So people get restless under that kind of situation. They rebel, they organize, they resist. And when that happens, of course, you need the power of the state to repress. And this is where Israel's military technology becomes very important. In order to pacify restless people under conditions of political and economic dispossession and disadvantage. One of the figures I cite in my article, and I have met him in Israel, is the Israeli anthropologist Jeff Halper, who's written a great book called War Against the People. And he speaks of how Israel is committed to what he calls global pacification, which is something of a euphemism, pacifying, for the military surveillance and all technology that is needed for use against communities in rebellion, or communities even that are just in long-term resistance and are dissenters. And by the way, this is why so much of Israel's surveillance technology and military equipment was used not only against the Highland Maya in Guatemala, but also against dissident urban intellectuals and students and anybody suspected of carrying out activity that might lend itself towards transformation of the fundamental conditions in Guatemala. You know, I cite the research being done on the basis of millions of pages, literally millions of pages of records found in the Guatemalan precinct basement showing the peoples interrogated and the surveillance equipment necessary for finding these people was incredibly sophisticated and again provided by Israel. The end results of all of this, I thought this was so interesting. In Guatemala, a number of officials will refer to the end result of all of this in Guatemala as Palestinianization.
Yes.
The Palestinianization of the land after massacre and under and for conditions of pacification, meaning repression and dampening down any resistant spirit. So Israel is deep into it in a global way. What we see through the lens of Guatemala and Israel and the United States, I think, is a seeing into of a global pacification process in which Israel and the United States are playing a key role in order to tamp down resistance, to make walls, invisible ones and not so visible ones, and very visible ones. Todd Miller, another journalist, writes about, I don't cite him in this article, but he's very informative in writing on what he calls the border industrial complex. And that building of borders, again, visible and invisible borders, is a specialty of Israeli and U.S. technology together, and it's instrumental to the pacification strategy.
We're going to take a break right here, but before we do, as I mentioned earlier, we did a show several weeks ago about the struggle for social justice in Honduras back in the 1980s, and we indirectly mentioned Israel or Israeli involvement in Honduras. And what you just said with regards to intelligence and the use of intelligence in Guatemala sounds very similar to what I discussed with regards to Honduras several weeks ago. So I would encourage everyone to go back to that episode to check it out. But in the meantime, we're speaking with Mark Lewis Taylor. He's a Maxwell Upson Professor of Theology and Culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Children can't resurrect them, can't forget that we got censored. And for those who didn't speak out, trust me, we remember. We won't forget the violence or the tyrants who want to dehumanize us. These times are unprecedented. First we wanted peace, now we want vengeance. A million refugees looking for shelter. I can't believe they put their hands out, we didn't help them. Can't drink the poison. Don't forget Starbucks funded the oppression. The list goes on, the boycott's coming. The boycott villains and his anger is summoned. Can you feel the tension burning in your stomach? Allah by my side won't surrender to nothing. And we won't forget nothing, nothing.
From Palestine to the Congo, we won't forget. Worldwide fit on pronto.
Qu'ils ont lancé sur nous pour cela. Nous vengerons par les chansons et nos voix. Prends cet enfant dans tes bras. Desde el río al mar, Palestine será libre. No pueden tratarnos como juguetes. No lo olvidaremos a los inocentes que mataron a ustedes. Mi Sudán y la Gaza. Anatadakr, wala nansa. Bi ruh mi dam. An nasru qarib had wa'adna. Filistin, dualar amdasin. All duro land, çocuklar unutmaya jaz. Onlar için savaşıyoruz biz. Sonsuza kadar. From Palestine to the Congo.
That was Carter Zahir, Jay Dean, and Shadiati, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Israel's role in genocide in Guatemala in the 1980s with Mark Lewis Taylor, who's a Maxwell Upson Professor of Theology and Culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. His recent article in Counterpunch is entitled Israel and Genocide, Not Only in Gaza. So before we took the break here, you mentioned the issue of Israeli intelligence in Guatemala. And I bring this up now because I want to learn more about it, because in 2022, I had the pleasure of speaking with Nelson Rauda, who's the journalist for El Faro based in El Salvador. And this was around the time when El Faro, or several people from El Faro, were suing the spyware Pegasus, the Israeli spyware Pegasus, for spying on journalists in El Salvador. And it sort of reminds me that, as I said before, a lot of what we're discussing here with regards to Guatemala that took place 40 years ago does not happen in a vacuum. They're just as relevant today as they were 40 years ago. So can you tell us a little bit more about the use of intelligence by Israelis with regards to Guatemala? Because, you know, another thing from that episode that we discussed in Honduras was the issue of torture and torture techniques. So what else can you tell us that could expand on not only just the arms that were being sold, but also the intelligence and the practices, or the Palestinianization, as you mentioned, that was being used by the Guatemalan dictatorship via Israeli support?
There's a lot that could be explored further than I do in my article. I think the most detailed analysis of this so far, and it really is worth careful reading by all of us, it's very accessibly written, is this study that I referred to by Jeff Halper called War Against the People, Israel, Palestinians, and Global Pacification. He looks not only at the military equipment, but at the surveillance equipment. And he does it by looking at the pamphlets and advertisements of the Israeli military institute itself. Just in February, by the way, there was an air show of military equipment with accompanying surveillance materials that was held in Singapore. That's February of this year. And Israel could not go to such a show when it was held in Dubai in November, because we are right there in the early months of the onslaught against Gaza, and in Dubai, you know, that just could not be tolerated. But in Singapore in February, it was tolerated, and Israel was showcasing its military and its surveillance, a very sophisticated equipment. This needs to be put in perspective, because this surveillance industry just doesn't go away. In fact, it grows more complex and more insidious in many ways. And I think we have to understand why. And for me, I keep coming back again to an imperial, geopolitical, economic set of interests and concerns that global North powers, like the United States and the EU and others, have in controlling resistance among subordinated populations in largely global South countries, but in some sectors of the global North too, that experience forms of this repression. Your audience probably knows well about, since 1821 and President James Monroe's Monroe Doctrine, the United States has declared to many other countries that Latin America will be for America, in the sense of U.S. America. There are more contemporary books by Latin American scholars and historians about, one called tellingly, Beneath the United States, referring to the South that is beneath the U.S. on a map. But the attitudes of racism combined with political and economic exploitation that the United States structured into its relationship with Latin America. This is still ongoing, not only with respect to the American continents, but other continents as well, and in the Middle East. Well, I mentioned that primarily to remind that in that kind of global political unjust arrangement, pacification and surveillance are going to be needed. I don't know if some of your readers may read Amira Haas, a critical opinion columnist in Haaretz magazine. She lives and has lived in Gaza and lives in Palestine, and she documents the minute knowledge that the Israeli forces have on almost every block in communities of Palestine, the West Bank, and Gaza, and elsewhere, because of its technology. And if we've been reading also, we know that many of the attacks perpetrated in Gaza by Israel were the result of very sophisticated algorithmic technologies. They carried names like Lavender. Another one was named, in fact, Gospel. Another one, rather insidiously, is called Where's Daddy? It's a mode of surveillance that could tell when someone believed to be a terrorist went home to their family and children, and then they would strike that house at that particular time. You can read this in the journal entitled Plus 972, it's called. So the surveillance paired and meshed with the military equipment is incredibly sophisticated, and we can talk about that, but I do think it needs to be put continually in this historical and political context of the global North's imperial political economy and the way that is structured.
I'm just writing down the list of all these people that you mentioned so I can have them on the show in the future.
Okay.
To further expand upon this, you know.
Indeed.
So let's go to the issue of racism, since you just kind of mentioned it a little bit, because despite this cozy relationship between Israel and the Guatemalan dictatorship in the 1980s, can you tell us about both the racist and fascist views Israeli had towards Guatemala? Because we've mentioned Jeff Halper a lot during the course of this conversation.
Yes.
And Jeff Halper, I think he cited an Israeli lieutenant by name of Amadzia Shwali. Mm. And he had an interesting quote here when he mentioned to a fellow Israeli, quote, "I don't care what the Gentiles do with the arms. The main thing is that the Jews profit," end quote. This is a quote from an Israeli lieutenant colonel. And it kind of reminds me of a certain scene in The Godfather where one of the capos made racist remarks to the black community in that film. But I wonder if you could expand upon this, because it's rather odd, but also telling with regards to what we've seen in recent times with regards to the overt racism towards Palestinians in Gaza today.
Yeah. This is a very important question and one that has to be talked about rightly. I worked hard to find and then document and verify that quote I have about Amadzia Shwali, who's saying what you just quoted. "I don't care what the Gentiles do with the arms. The main thing is that the Jews profit." So they don't care who suffers. And usually they don't care when it's, of course, not them, or it's when it's a people that they can disparage as being of another people or another race within a racist formula. But one story I came across that I did not include in the article was a debate going on in the nation of Belize, just to the north, I believe, of Guatemala, and they were contemplating taking in Israeli aid. And one of the columnists and journalists actually quoted this very same passage by Amadzia Shwali that you just read and said, "What do you think Israelis will believe about us and so many of our black citizens in this country?"
Wow.
And so they picked up right away and named the racism that they thought they would be subject to. This points to another very important literature that I believe we need to grapple with, and I myself am still exploring it. And Ilan Pappe, the great historian of Israel and Palestine, himself also an Israeli historian, but very much critical of Zionists, he argues and points out that Zionism is a form of racism and needs to be understood as such. It's an exaltation of a certain kind of Jewish hegemony over land that is dependent on either denying the existence of other people or holding those people, other people in Palestine, in lower positions, seeing them as near to the animal, the vermin. You have much of this language that has been part of white supremacy. I didn't quote the sources on this, but the number of historians and sociologists of race that are analyzing Zionism in relation to white supremacy is great. And you can see it in some of those passages of the South Africa's petition to the International Court. And again, the language on vermin, and these are not humans. These are less than animal, even, was one of the expressions used and is quoted in the South Africans' petition on genocide to the International Court. So this is a pattern in any book on U.S. policy initiatives. I refer again to the one entitled Beneath the United States. The author, a historian at Stanford University, gives numerous examples of U.S. office holders who viewed Central American peoples as of another breed, as one of them put it, as another race contaminated by a Spanish heritage. All of this language has been used in various ways that historians make clear. You know, I won't quote it right here, but George H.W. Bush, when going into a major meeting in Nicaragua to seek for peace at the time when Nicaragua was quite a hot spot, he used very racially disparaging language about the Nicaraguan leaders that he did not want to deign to discuss important matters with. So the racism and the white supremacy is at work in both contexts, and it needs to be analyzed.
I'm going to have to go back to my Belizean friends and contacts and ask them about this, because that's stunning. You know, that is stunning.
I'll send you the article. It's an interesting piece.
Oh, yeah, please do, because we're almost out of time here. And I want to tell you something that I told you before we started, was that we're going to pack a lot of information here. But even then, I feel like we just scratched the surface.
Indeed.
Which is why we're going to create a link to your counterpart article so people can learn more about this piece of history that is sorely underreported in these current times with regards to everything that's been going on in Gaza. So because we have about 5 minutes left, while everything we have discussed remains out of the picture in corporate media's narrative on the massacre in Gaza, does Guatemala, I guess we've sort of answered this, sort of explain why the Global South has manifested in solidarity with the people of Gaza? And just to be clear, there are other countries that have also had its democracy undermined by the Israeli government as well, in one form or another, in the last 40 years alone. And again, my focus on this question was initially on the Global South, but as we have this conversation today, you know, Columbia University and the protests that have been taking place by students has gotten national attention. There's some other schools that have done similar things, and it seems to be growing. So this extends beyond the Global South as well, with regards to Gaza solidarity. So what do you make of this as this solidarity continues to grow and develop, not just in campuses, not just in the Global South, but beyond that?
Yeah. And it is a time, it's quite striking to me that since the time of my first entry into solidarity with Palestine through kind of what I call the southern door of my interests in Guatemala, I have never seen a movement for Palestine as strong as it is now, either inside the United States or in other contexts over the world, in the Global South and the Global North. I mentioned to you that my article was read by some in Guatemala and Honduras who asked to get it published in Spanish in the North American Council of Latin America Reporter. And I was very glad for that, because it also showed me how much writing was going on right now about Gaza and Palestine in places like Guatemala and Honduras, the protests that are emerging there. I've been quite intrigued with the arts and music worldwide that are taking up the concerns. There's this great new hip-hop song from Congo to Palestine.
Yeah, we played it during the break.
We will not forget. Yeah. It is a pulling together of some of the exploitation going on in the Congo right now of child labor for the nutrient elements that are used in electric cars and other alternative energy, about that site of suffering, and then this suffering going on in Gaza and Palestine as well. So what I observe that is very distinctive and kind of holds together this new development is the discourse of settler colonialism. This has been taught for quite a while in our schools, but it has become owned by activists of very many walks of life. And it enables people to come into this movement who not only want to strike solidarity with Gaza and Palestinians against the U.S.-backed Israel, but people concerned about indigenous rights in the United States and all over Abya Yala, the name for indigenous North and South and Central America. From indigenous point of view, settler colonialism also has made place for an understanding of enslavement and those who live in the afterlife of slavery, as our Black brothers and sisters do too. So this narrative of settler colonialism has enabled many different kinds of groups to come together from different kinds of spaces of concern. And I find it fascinating to note how that notion of settler colonialism, which also includes the attention to capitalism and political economy that I was mentioning, is operative on the lips of many an activist, not just Nui academics.
Yeah, no one knows how the story of Gaza is going to end.
Indeed.
But with regards to the issue of settler colonialism, hopefully the narrative and the very idea of settler colonialism continues to remain under the magnifying glass, especially if we were to expand it to places like Puerto Rico, Western Sahara, Guam, just to name a few places. And so this lends itself to the importance of this article, which is, again, why we're going to create a link to this article so people can learn more about this forgotten moment in Central American history. We've been speaking with Mark Lewis Taylor. He's a Maxwell Upson Professor of Theology and Culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. And once again, his article in Counterpunch is entitled Israel and Genocide, Not Only in Gaza. Once again, we're going to create a link to it. But in the meantime, Mark Lewis Taylor, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whisperns, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. U.S. Army engineers yesterday began construction of a floating pier and causeway for humanitarian aid off the coast of Gaza. The construction is meant to allow humanitarian aid to bypass Israeli restrictions on land convoys into Gaza. Aid organizations welcomed the plan, but also say the project is not an adequate substitute for land convoys. This comes as the United Nations warned on Wednesday about the risk of famine looming in northern Gaza. According to the UN's World Food Program, the Gaza Strip could meet famine thresholds for food insecurity, malnutrition, and mortality within only 6 weeks. The Ukrainian military has pulled back U.S.-provided Abrams tanks amid destructive attacks by Russian drones. Five of the 31 Abrams tanks shipped to Ukraine last year have been lost to Russian attacks. Officials say the proliferation of surveillance and attack drones above the Ukrainian battlefield mean quick detection of large vehicles is likely. U.S. officials pledged to work with their Ukrainian counterparts to rethink tactics to allow the tanks to re-enter the war. A group of 50 countries comprising the Ukraine Defense Contact Group is scheduled to meet today. The Federal Communications Commission yesterday voted to restore net neutrality rules that had been repealed by former President Donald Trump. The rules were first put in place under the Obama administration and require providers of internet service to treat all traffic equally. That means broadband internet providers such as Comcast and Verizon are prevented from blocking or degrading the delivery of services from competitors like Netflix and YouTube. The rules also block providers from providing higher speeds to customers willing to pay for them. The measure passed on a 3-2 vote split along party lines, with Democratic commissioners in favor and Republicans opposed. Broadband providers are expected to sue to try to overturn the reinstated rules. A Panama-flagged ship that had been stranded in the port of Baltimore since the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse last month was able to exit the port yesterday, using a newly opened deepwater channel. The ship that departed is one of five expected to leave the port through the new channel. Other ships are scheduled to enter. The opening of the 35-foot deep channel puts the Key Bridge cleanup effort slightly ahead of schedule. Officials say they plan to keep the new channel open until Monday or Tuesday, at which point it will close again until roughly May 10th to allow for workers to clear debris and refloat the Dolly container ship, which caused the bridge collapse when it crashed into a support strut. In a court filing made Monday, Baltimore's mayor and city council said the Dolly's owner and manager should be found fully liable for the bridge collapse. The United Auto Workers Union is poised to strike at six Daimler truck facilities in the U.S. South if the company doesn't reach a new labor agreement by the end of today. UAW President Sean Fain said in an online address earlier this week that workers are demanding better pay, including cost of living adjustments and greater job security.
The workers are going to come for their fair share. In the new UAW, we don't take concessions. We raise standards for everyone, and we fight for what we deserve. And we're not afraid to strike to get it.
Fain is expected to hold a press conference at 8 p.m. Eastern tonight, when he will likely announce whether a strike at Daimler will happen. 96% of Daimler UAW members voted to authorize a strike in March.